I just found myself developing a kind of almost evangelistic role, just reminding people, not that print was going to beat digital. It wasn't an either or. It was just simply that digital was there and print was going to be there. Print wasn't going anywhere, not yet. And I don't see now that print is ever going to disappear. It's completely central to the idea of content.
Jeremy Leslie is a magazine person, a lifer. He's had his hands in a diverse group of publications and media, including Time Out, The Guardian, Blitz, and many others. Since 2006, he has led Mag Culture, which started as a research project, became a well-respected blog, but now includes a retail outlet in London, a consultancy, events and conferences, and really anything magazine. He has written books about editorial design and magazines, and his talents are sought after by clients the world over. Mag Culture, however, is more than a mere destination for magazine lovers. It is a resource and, perhaps more than anything, an evangelist for all things magazine. Its existence has been a boon to indie mags the world over. Mag Culture continues to produce a vast array of content on all sorts of platforms and channels, and all of them are worth your while. Mag Culture's battle cry, something they shout from the rooftops, is a simple one and one that we at Magazine share. We love magazines. Jeremy is arguably the best person to speak to about the state of the magazine today and what the future of the magazine might be. My name is Arjun Basu, and this is The Full Bleed. If there wasn't someone in the United States called Mr. Magazine, I would call you Mr. Magazine. Why don't you tell everyone about your journey to this point?
How far do you want me to go back?
There's a lot there. Just a brief, abridged version of your journey to Mag Culture.
Now, I've been working in publishing now 40 years, I think, or give it maybe 38, 39. But I mean, looking back, I'm amazed to calculate it's around about 40 years of working in magazines so far. My first interest in magazines was simply through content, through reading a music magazine called the New Musical Express back in the 80s, late 70s, 80s. That's where I first got the magazine bug, albeit without realizing I was getting the bug. I was just a teenager into the music, and that was the first magazine that really engaged me. But then if I zoom forward from there, I went on to study graphic design at the London College of Printing, which is now the London College of Communication. And even when, as I was studying design there, I hadn't really figured that magazines and design had a huge crossover. I was still obsessed with music and reading The Enemy, and then I was doing this design thing. But of course, the two kind of came together.
Did you get into design thinking you were going to music and do album covers, or were you not even thinking that far yet? Those were two separate interests.
No, it wasn't even... You can look back in all these situations and patch together a really convincing kind of plan, strategy of a story, but it wasn't that organized at all. I hadn't done very well academically at school. My art teacher was a hero, and he sensed that I was quite good at typography and structure, so he said graphic design. He pushed me in that direction, and I went off obligingly and then found this world that was my people. But there was no big plan to it. It fell into place thanks to the good thoughts of some decent people around me and the support of my parents. So there wasn't a goal at the end of that, but I didn't immediately click with it all. But as it transpired, you know, studying, and then I got very into design. I had some conflict with my tutors and the people teaching me there, but I found a way out by moving out of typography and into moving image, which took me actually naturally away from print and the potential for magazine design, but actually stood me in good stead later on in other respects of what I do. But then it was when I left university and I covered for somebody in a magazine design studio over the summer for 2 or 3 weeks, and I just got the bug there and then. That was City Limits magazine, which was a listings magazine in London that had set up as a kind of competitor, as an alternative to Time Out, which is probably a better known brand. And I just, the craft of putting together pages on a magazine, listings, nothing special. It wasn't about design. It was about getting stuff done and keeping it straight and making it work. But I loved the immediacy of it, the rushing on print day to get it all out. And then the following morning, you come into the office and there was the printed item.
Yeah, there was and continues to be just this magical part of that process where you go from screen to page and you touch it.
Yeah, I think that's an underlying almost anything I can say about magazines. That is the key thing, is that the fact that something is in your hands at the end of it.
Yeah, the sensual nature of the medium.
You're right. It's the central side. We're so used to our screens in every sense, whether it's the screen we're recording this on or our phone, that we take for granted that there's really only one sense being engaged when we're reading in that environment, and that is your eyes, your visual. With the magazine, you get sound and touch and smell. It's a much more all-round engaging prospect.
So then you did a lot. We don't have to go through every step of your journey, but you landed with Mag Culture, which started as a blog.
Mm-hmm.
And what were you missing that made you decide that I'd like to share my joy with the medium?
Well, as you said, I worked through various different businesses from the early style magazine Blitz. I was art director at Time Out. And then I was at John Brown producing contract or customer magazines, custom publishing for the 10 years of the noughties. And as while I was at John Brown, I really began to develop bigger ideas about around what magazines could be. And at the turn of the century, around about 2001, 2003, I published a couple of books about magazine design, which were sort of key to the later developments. The second of those books was called Mag Culture, and that did well enough that the publishers were interested in doing a second volume or second edition or a follow-up book. And I've always been interested in new technology and experimenting with things. And I was interested in the idea of blogging, and I just registered magculture.com and pondered the idea of having a website which could be the research tool for the next book. And that's what it was. It was a very simple WordPress template, a free one. There was no money behind it. I was still working full-time at John Brown, but I just set it up as a little experiment on the side, and it blew up. There was nothing else out there writing about magazines really at all, let alone from the design aspect, or primarily the design aspect. So it just caught a moment. And looking back, I realized it was the same time big publishing businesses were investing in proper broadband access for their staff in the office. Suddenly, the internet was a legitimate business tool. And the people who might be my audience, the people working in publishing from a creative standpoint, suddenly had the internet on their desk and they wanted something to read. And my little blog turned up, and it was a very timely kind of coincidence.
It's the right blog at the right time.
The nice phraseology. I like that. Yes, the right blog at the right time, indeed. And so it was really a research tool that sort of became something else. And I really enjoyed working with it and developing it and writing. And I found a voice, and I began to get a lot of feedback from people who were reading it back in the day when you could have comments safely. And it just went from there. That was the beginning of Mag Culture.
When did you realize it was something actually more than a research project?
It started in 2006, and it took a couple of years. But I found I was getting invited to speak at more conferences, and that just drove me on, because I found myself getting invited to speak at conferences as, frankly, the odd one out. All these publishing conferences at that stage were obsessed with digital and were obsessed with moving everything onto the phone, even though it's pre-Apple iPhone. But the future was digital. And so you'd have what were once quite creatively orientated conferences about publishing going on, and every other speaker's talking about the death of print and talking about print was over and the future is digital and holding up their Nokia. And I just didn't buy that. And so I'd then stand up and I'd deliver my talk reminding people that there's this fantastic new generation of magazines that I was collecting and observing and noting. And I just found myself developing a kind of almost evangelistic role, just reminding people, not that print was going to beat digital, or it wasn't an either or. Print wasn't going anywhere, not yet. And I don't see now that print is ever going to disappear completely. It's completely central to the idea of content.
There was a panic, I think, within the industry overall. A lot of it had to do probably with the advertising industry looking at the new shiny thing and going, oh my gosh. But that panic, it led a lot of print people to sort of adapt to digital. And I kept saying, print needs to actually get printier now. It's such a tactile thing. It needs to be more tactile, and it needs to highlight its strengths. And that wasn't what was happening. It was just a general panic in the industry.
I think that there were several stages of panic, and I think the solutions brought to try and mitigate that situation that was causing the panic were completely upside down. Things needed to be printier or more magazine-y, as I say, and actually the big publishers opted for the opposite. They opted to cut corners and reduce quality and drop the level of the paper and generally just try to keep their profit margins up when a little bit of investment in print, albeit alongside digital, might have stood them a lot better for the future. But you can't point your finger at one event or one thing or one reason, but there was a whole kind of series of situations and panics and things that just played into the hands of people that wanted to do digital.
What is your definition of a magazine? Has it changed over time?
I'm very clear what a magazine is. A magazine is any cultural item or object or event which is part of a series.
So that's interesting, because I always called conferences and events experiential, whatever you want to call it, content farms, because you could just do so much with those and they could go onto any format, print, they could be reported on, they could be video, they could be audio. So that's an interesting idea you just threw in there, that it's this series of connected things, no matter how they originated.
Absolutely. You know, the event reference I'm thinking of is Pop-Up Magazine. Do you know that project? Yeah.
Yes.
That is a magazine conceived as an event. It's not taking an event and saying it's a magazine. It's a publication that's comes off the page and into a live environment, but it's very definitely positioned as a magazine, as the spring issue and the fall issue. But the point is, it's a series of issues, and that one comes out as a series of events. Of course, most magazines come out as more familiar formats in print. And this isn't a new thing. You go back to the 60s and something like Aspen magazine, which was a kind of box full of bits of various things created by different artists and contributors. And you go back to the meaning of the word magazine. It relates to, in various languages, storehouse and shop and collection. You have a magazine of bullets that you put in a gun. The idea of a magazine, the name magazine only got applied to what we know as magazine today in 1873 with the Gentleman's Magazine here in the UK. But before that, they existed without having the name magazine. And a magazine is just another word like review or journal or whatever. But the word magazine frees you up, I think. And if you look at the meaning and the etymology of and origins of that word, it can really help open up what you think a magazine is.
I read two things in preparation for this. One was a story in GQ, and one was a Substack by Joe Berger, who writes about magazines. And both of them were asking the same question. Are print magazines a luxury item now or an elite pursuit? I understand why it's being framed that way. I don't really agree, obviously. I wonder what you thought of that.
I've read one of those pieces and I understand the argument, but I think it's a sort of irrelevant argument. I think there are definitely magazines that are being created from the point of view of wanting to be a luxury item and wanting to be in that market in terms of rarity and value and et cetera. But I think that's always been the case. I think there's always been magazines of that ilk. But equally, I think there's magazines which are much more down and dirty and much more kind of wanting to attract a very different audience. And I think that's one of the joys of it is the variety. And I think, you know, something I read recently was Jeff Jarvis's book about his experience in magazines. I'm sure you've seen that. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting tale of the high life of the sort of 70s and 80s, the New York publishing industry and retelling the stories of the drinks truck that went round the Time building every day at 5 o'clock and whatever, and the expenditure and your expectation and getting into trouble for not spending enough money on your expenses and all this kind of overblown stuff, which all sounds fantastic. And you can get into conversation with the people, oh, those are the days. But were those the days? My feeling about the kind of that those big days of magazines was, I've spent a lot of time in New York, and when I was working at John Brown, we used to have an office in Manhattan. I'd be out there quite a bit. And I'd come through the airport and look at Hudson News and see all this really glossy covers shining, not just the ones that remain now, but all the other ones, you know, all the Condé Nast and Hearst titles, rows and rows of them, all brightly lit and colourful and vivid and very exciting. And I remember judging the SPD Awards in New York and being amazed by this extraordinary typographics and such. Very impressive. And there was that era of Scott Dadich and Brandon Cavula and great designers who all now moved on to the West Coast and working in tech of one sort or the other. And that was a great time. It was a great time creatively. And we in London looked across there with great envy at the resources and the time that people had to spend on these projects. But I wonder in retrospect, I mean, in a way, it was all very much the same. And in a way, I think we're in danger of allowing nostalgia to overawe us. And I think at any time, you can go back through different eras. There's always something interesting going on in the world of publishing, and that's the case now.
You know, no matter what the magazine is, if it's a down and dirty mimeographed zine right up to something obviously very expensive, I've always thought magazines are aspirational more than anything else.
Absolutely. I think people frown upon the idea of aspiration, but I think that's what we want. People are naturally ambitious and wanting to find out about the next thing. But you're right, ambition and aspiration are a part of it. But I think that's a key kind of human quality, isn't it? To aspire and to want to know more and to find out more. And I think magazines are great ways of doing that. Of course, it can go a bit sour if you're kind of flicking through pages, aspiring to have things that you can't afford to have. And there's that side to it. There's also the healthier kind of side to aspiration in terms of bettering yourself and learning more and developing yourself.
100%. But coming from the custom world, the brands that understood the tactile and sensual nature of magazines were tactile and sensual themselves, and that was fashion and luxury. They understood that, and that's why they still advertise so much in traditional magazines.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You are, for want of a better word, you're a curator of the new magazines. How does something get on your radar? How do you discover them?
As I said, the Mag Culture blog, as it was, started in 2006. So I've been at this now. And before that, in 2001, my first book came out. So I've been in this in one way or the other for 23 years. People come to me. People come to us. People come to Mag Culture now.
Are you like a stamp of approval now? In a way, that might make you uncomfortable, but
I feel that there's a bit more of the story to explain, to flesh this out. I was running this little side project, the Mag Culture blog, and that was beginning to grow an audience and get people interested in me for other reasons than my design career. And I had this kind of parallel thing going on. I was designing at John Brown, and I was writing and contributing to conferences, writing for other publications about editorial design, etc., beginning to teach a bit. And my time at John Brown came to an end in 2009, and I just decided to migrate myself into the name Mag Culture, and the Mag Culture studio started up, and I began to work with clients of my own in that respect, various things here and in Europe and the States. And then alongside that, we opened the shop, and my studio was situated behind the shop. So it was an all-in-one kind of site with the retail shop selling the magazines that we were heroing, and the business running the consultancy and design behind it. And so, you know, across the 23 years, the sort of my voice in terms of talking about and highlighting certain magazines and what's happening in the scene has developed, and we get, you know, we're it's like there's a big lightning conductor above the building that says send us your magazines. So we get sent stuff all the time. We reach out and see stuff. We'll find stuff on Instagram. People wandering off the street show us their magazines, all sorts of ways. I look back now and realize there's been two enormous catalysts for Mag Culture as an entity, and that was the website back in 2006, which sort of create the digital space. But I didn't realize how much more in addition the physical space of having a shop would add. And that's been extraordinary, not just because it's a shop, but because it attracts attention and people come in and they want to know about what's going on. People are either already on board and want to just know more, or else they come in and they look around and they're just like, what is this place? This is a magazine shop? Are you crazy? And so it's a fantastic vehicle for explaining what's going on.
And then they touch the magazines. You can't do that online, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is an entirely different experience. And the reality is that any business, mine included, all the magazines we sell rely on the internet. Of course, they're primarily print projects, but they wouldn't exist. And there's a sort of paradox built into this in the sense that so many magazines, for instance, the New Musical Express that I started off this conversation as a kind of a touchstone for first got me involved in magazines, the internet brought it down. It was a weekly news and listings magazine.
Yeah.
And that kind of semi-professional kind of functioning, you know, making money out of all the advertising, that kind of project is long dead because of the internet. But meanwhile, what the internet has done positively has empowered smaller magazines to launch, and within months, they're selling copies across the world because of the internet.
We'll be right back. Print is Dead is made possible by the support of the Society of Publication Designers. The SPD powers the future of visual storytelling, setting the standard for editorial excellence and shaping the future of visual culture. For more information, visit spd.org.
Do you find, you know, as a Londoner, and London's always been a magazine center, or printed word center, let's just say, and then going to New York and seeing what they have. Do you find that the geography of magazines, like where the creative output is coming from, changes and shifts over time? Because I feel that's true. I don't know if that's my own impression or if that's actually...
No, it does change. In terms of the English language, I'm very clear that the traditional centers of excellence are London and New York. Maybe one or two other cities might argue the toss, but I would say London and New York are the heart of the English-speaking magazine publishing worlds. But it's interesting to see what happens elsewhere and how different cities, the sort of the slightly smaller cities, are more creatively orientated than the bigger full-on cities. So, for instance, in the UK, Manchester and Bristol have contributed a lot to all sorts of creativity, not just magazine publishing. But they have, and Bristol was a centre for some stage, and then suddenly that sort of fades away somehow. Right now I'm seeing there's a lot in Paris, which has always been culturally interesting as a city and a lot going on, but has always been rather closed from a publishing perspective because of the kind of like the French approach and indeed legal approach to publishing in their own language, and things are set up to protect themselves against the anglification of everything they do. But now there's a new generation of really interesting independent magazines coming from mainly Paris that are in English and are developing international readership. Amsterdam's big. So yeah, I think it's a sort of strange kind of cross-fertilization.
And it happens in every medium. It happens in music. It happens in everything.
Yeah.
In magazines, it's interesting because we're talking about English magazines, and it does move around. Amsterdam for sure, Paris. There was a short time where it was Belgium and fashion magazines. I keep thinking of Australia and their impact on food magazines from the 90s and the aughts, and we're still feeling that impact in terms of the design of a food magazine and a blog. Researching this show, not this show in particular, but the series, I'm starting to see all these bilingual magazines coming out of China, out of Shanghai in particular, which are really interesting. And I know your store carries some of them. And yeah, those centers of excellence just move around in the English language. In Canada, where I am, the most interesting magazines in this country are French, and they come from Montreal, and they're beautiful, and they're interesting. They're fearless in a weird way that the rest of the country isn't managing. So there just seem to be these periods of creative churn that are geographic.
I think that's right. But I think also you have to understand it is a very international market today. And I think whilst you can observe bright spots at various times, the reality is now everyone's looking at what different cities are doing, and everyone's very conscious of what's happening elsewhere. The new independent scene, the current independent scene, it has hot spots all across the world, but those hot spots are all networked together, and MagCulture is part of that network. And in your country, you have Issues in Toronto, and in Germany, there's Do You Read Me, and there's the Athenaeum in Amsterdam, and all these shops. We all know each other, and we're supportive of each other, and we know how difficult it is to make these magazines and to make them work. So we're all trying to push them along and encourage them to keep going.
What would you advise someone who is in that position, who's being encouraged but wants to start something interesting from an obviously creative point of view, from a content point of view, from a business point of view? If someone came to you, walked into the store and found you and said, what should I do? What would you say?
I have said in the past, don't. But not because I don't think they should, but because I think it's going to be really hard. And you need to be quite clear that it's not going to be simple. It's not going to be easy. It's more than just, that looks fun, let's do it.
That was always true.
Yeah, exactly. Making a magazine, even making a not very good magazine, is really hard work. So what I would say to them is make the magazine you really want to make. Talk to people, take on advice, listen, but be true to what your idea is and do something that is yours. Do something that you can 100% stand behind and say, success or failure, this was great. I believed in this and I really thought it could go. And if it doesn't go, it doesn't go. But the alternative is you listen to too many people and you look at too many other magazines and you think maybe we could do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and that could just find a little slot in a market and the blah, blah. Forget all that. Just make the best thing that you can do that aligns with what you want to be doing, because that's what it's about. Make something you're proud of. If you believe in it, it's then your job to get out there and get other people to believe in it.
Do you have any idea about the future of the form or the medium or even where the magazine will sit in the larger landscape? It feels like a diminished product, but a product that endures. And it's only a diminished product because other things seem to have rushed in and reduced its space in many ways.
I look at it the other way around. I see the failure of the mainstream publishers as leaving a wide open space for these independents, for magazines. And that's what's happening. A lot of people have an ambition to make a magazine, and there's all sorts of reasons why, but definitely one of them is they might have trained as a designer or a journalist or whatever, and they want to work in publishing, but there are no entry-level jobs anymore. So they'll start their own thing. There were several magazines that launched at the turn of the century, which kind of started me thinking on what is happening in this new generation of magazines. I'm thinking of things like Fantastic Man, O32C, Appartamento, all of which now are really strong, established businesses. They're not vanity projects. They are passion projects, but they are actual businesses with members of staff that are on full-time salary, producing something that's very strong, still strong and true to its original self, but big, challenging, scratching at the bottom of where the mainstreams were at one stage. But I saw these magazines happening and I've been following them, and there's an endless supply of young people wanting to make these new magazines, and a lot of them will go on and succeed. It's brilliant. It's a really exciting time. But I also think that there's a lot of focus on this idea that there's a new generation of independent magazines, and I've been talking about that and using that phrase, and I stand by that phrase. But I'm also aware that historically, there's always been an interesting kind of counter alternative world of publishing alongside. If you look at the 60s, the very brief kind of précis of what happened in the 60s, highlight two big things. One was the realization of the post-Second World War consumer boom, men's magazines, women's magazines, the fabulous Esquire covers that George Lois did. But you can also look at the extraordinary counterculture of Friends, Rolling Stone, IT, Oz, these magazines, which were in effect the independent magazines, as we call them, of their day. And if you go back to the 50s and rock and roll fanzines, you come forward to the 70s and punk zines, the 80s with the Star magazines, which I was a part of at Blitz. There's always been these magazines and the young upstarts trying to turn over the cart. And we're just seeing that again with this generation of magazines. And in terms of what the future is, I can only see a healthy future when I look around me. And I think it's easy to observe that these are more expensive as publications. They are sometimes self-defined as luxury. There's a number of lifestyle magazines. They can veer towards the bland sometimes, some of them. But there's also, alongside that, there's all sorts of other really exciting projects. And we're seeing great big swathes of new magazines about climate change,
yep,
about LGBT, about technology, AI. There's a thing happening here in the UK at the moment about the new interest in folk and folklore. So there's a bunch of magazines like Rome and Weird Walks. The printed zine, the printed magazine, still has a fantastic role to enter into a discussion or an interest in a particular area, however small initially or minority the interest in that area is, and help grow it. And that's what we see again and again. It's important for me to get across that there are magazines about sport and fashion and the traditional tropes of publishing. But there's also magazines taking on the big issues of the day, and they're doing it really well.
So what are three magazines now that are really making you tick, that are really exciting you?
If you could ask me this last week, you could ask me this next week, and I'd probably come up with something different. So, but rather than just give you my latest favorite, we always publish a magazine of the month on the Mag Culture Journal. So there's always something. But I think ones which have already begun to establish and last have got an absolutely foreseeable future. I would recommend MacGuffin, which is a magazine from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam, which is published in English. And MacGuffin subtitles itself The Life of Things, which I think there's a fine art to the baselines underneath your logo. And I think that this is one of the most fabulous baselines I've ever come across, is The Life of Things. It contains a kind of paradox in four words, but it takes a single object for each issue or thing and uses that as a starting point for a research into all aspects of that object and seeing what fact they find out. So they've done, I think it's issue 13 is out at the moment. And it is about the letter, as in the alphabet. And so it's not a straightforward history of the alphabet by any means, but the alphabet, the letter, is just used. It's not straightforward. It uses the letter as a starting point. So we hear about all forms of media, communication, the game Scrabble, some of the history in terms of different scripts and such. But what you get is a bit of design, a bit of communication, a bit of media, a bit of games, a bit of history. You get all these different aspects. So on the one hand, it's consistently about one thing each issue. And previously, they've done the bed, they've done the bottle, they've done rope, they've done the window. But each one is just squeezing you through this little tiny keyhole, which is really narrow. But actually, you come through that keyhole and you see this whole world, which might involve history, sociology, archaeology, some stuff very modern, some stuff very historic. As it's a familiar template, but every issue is a complete surprise. And I think it's brilliant. And it's not just a great idea, but the execution of the thing is always fantastic. The best writers, great photography, beautifully art directed, etc. So I recommend MacGuffin. And that also highlights the very powerful difference between print and digital. I think it would be a great blog. And I think I'd probably bookmark it and I'd probably forget about it.
A blog or a podcast. It could be that. Yeah.
So MacGuffin.
MacGuffin, one, two.
Then I would propose less of a magazine, more of a series of magazines made by one person, and that is Richard Turley, New York-based British art director, who has been responsible for a number of things. He made his name doing Bloomberg Business Week when it was still a weekly. He did some extraordinary work there, but he subsequently moved out of publishing for a period into TV and music and advertising. But like all the best publishing-obsessed art directors, he's found himself back in publishing again. He puts together Interview Magazine, which I think is going through one of its... There's not many magazines that manage to have several lives. Another magazine would just be happy with one of those lives. Interview, Andy Warhol's late 60s vehicle for celebrity. He's going through one of its purple patches right now, courtesy of Richard and the way he and Mel Ottenberg, the stylist and fashion director, has developed that. But in addition to that, he's still publishing his own stuff. And I think Civilization was a superb project that he did. It was a small... Not physically small, but it was small in the sense there were only 2,000 copies and they did 6 editions to date randomly when they can. But it's a huge broadsheet, a piece of newspaper publishing, which is just the absolute kind of iteration of the information overload that we suffer today through digital. These huge broadsheet pages are absolutely packed with information that is banal, but it's the sort of thing I could never design. It's the sort of thing that's a very personal project. It has something to say. It's almost a sort of a piece of art provocation. It's Dadaesque. It's fantastically contrary, and I love it for the fact that it is just completely different to anything else that's out there. It's a zine been reborn into a broadsheet newspaper. You could pull out the pages and frame them as artworks. I'm really excited about that project.
Yeah.
But then even more exciting, I think, now is his new magazine, Nuts, which is a stunning piece of publishing as a physical object. And I think it's notable that both Civilization and Nuts, it's all about the physical nature of it. The broadsheet format is absurd and contrary and a brilliant choice. Not even a newspaper. A newspaper's not going to launch into print today anyway, but if they did, they wouldn't be launching into broadsheet. And Nuts is really well researched in terms of the paper. It's this really thick, bulky, but extraordinary light paper stock, which is quite matte. It's all printed in black and white, and it's like the ghost of a fashion magazine. It's full-bleed imagery with big headlines, which are esoteric to the point of poetry. And you flick through it and you think this is a fashion magazine, but it's not a fashion magazine. It's just pictures of people in fashion-y type settings. There's professional photography.
It's almost like a simulacrum.
Yeah, it might almost be what if you prompted an AI to create a fashion magazine and put the right prompt in. It might be that this is what came out the other end. It's fascinating, and I think it's brilliant. And what I like about both those two particular projects is they're really challenging of what a magazine can be. And I love projects that question the point and the form and make you wonder, is this a magazine or not?
That's a question we ask a lot.
Yeah, that the fact that stuff like this is being made and made to such a level of quality is another argument that there's a future in this format. People are investigating it and experimenting with it and pushing at the edges to see what happened if, what if. And that idea of balancing working on a big project like Interview with doing these smaller self-financed, self-developed projects.
Three.
The third one is something which is much more parochial in a way, and that is The Fence, which is a London-based magazine. And it's in the spirit of early Private Eye, our very British, very English satirical magazine. But it's also completely different to Private Eye. And it's very slight. It's very different to the other two magazines I've mentioned, which are all very kind of conscious of their physical entity, their physical being. This is a magazine which is just 40-odd pages. It's quite thin. There's nothing special to its production, although it is well done. It's well done within what it is. It's well printed, but it's just black and red. It's only has illustrations and the pages of not working hard to make you read it. It's not over-embellished with design. There's a lot of illustration, but the content is fascinating because it's one of the few places where a lot of the young journalists in London and further afield who are generally perhaps tied to working in lifestyle environments or working online for fashion projects, etc., the fence let them go out and do longer research, long form writing projects about what's happening in the country. So you get reports about how London's becoming a cash-free city and what does that mean, and talking to people about the actual effect of that and is it a good thing. And so things like that, as well as more stories about sex abuse in public schools and things like this. So they do serious reporting. They also have a wicked sense of humour. They carry fiction, and there's nothing quite like it at the moment. It feels it's going back to another era of publishing, but they've made it very modern. And I have a lot of time for that project. As to the future, I'm excited by a lot of what's happening in the digital storytelling space, particularly from a more sort of print-orientated directions. For instance, I think the New York Times Magazine and the creative team there, led by Jake Silverstein and Gail Bickler, are going to be moving the magazine project into some very interesting spaces online in the following months, years. A bit more down and dirty, Byline is another New York project, which is run by young journalist Goots Guterman, late of Drunken Canal. It's a very print-orientated project, but it's purely online, and I find that an interesting experiment. They've yet to find their voice fully, and I'm not sure what the business model is, but for now, it's an exciting development, as is Airmail. I think everybody's been, well, certainly I've been a bit blindsided by Graydon Carter's success at making something out of his newsletter project. It's carrying on where he left off, really, in terms of Vanity Fair, but it's his own baby, and I can't help feeling that it's such a print-orientated background is going to lead him to make a print product sooner than later. And then in print, I'm eternally optimistic. I just think there is this difference between print and digital, and the key thing is the difference between reader and consumer. And I think people need a space away from their screens. I think people want a space where they are presented with a curated set of stories that will sometimes be familiar, sometimes be surprising.
This has been the Full Bleed Podcast, a series of short conversations with the people creating the magazines of the future. The Full Bleed is a production of Magazium, and this episode was produced by Patrick Mitchell. My name is Arjun Basu. Thank you for listening. Now go consume a magazine in the platform of your choice.
The Full Bleed Podcast is a production of Magazium and Modus Operandi Design. For more information, visit our website at magazium.co, where you can read complete transcripts of all of our interviews, along with portfolios, archival photos, links, and other great information. And be sure to visit Entry Points, our new blog, all about the world of magazines. Follow us on social media at We Are Magazium or at Print Is Dead Pod. And please give us a like and a review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps. Thanks very much for listening.